That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. We are back with a brand new miniseries. This is our fourth week of Romero Unseen. You've been here, you know that every Tuesday this March, we have been celebrating unmade films of George A. Romero with this very special, very interesting and insightful limited series. On today's fourth episode, that's right, number four, we are doing something a little bit different. We are unearthing Romero's, I'm going to call it his expedition into Bigfoot and found footage via a couple of different projects, but we're going to get to that later. Joining me, as always, for Romero Unseen, we have Adam Charles Hart. He is the author of Raising the Dead, the work of George A. Romero, which is out now from Oxford University Press. And if you go check out our episode notes, you can find out where you can buy your own copy. But that's not all. We are also joined by Dread Central's editor-in-chief, Mary Beth McAndrews, a self-proclaimed found footage defender and Bigfoot truther. Not really, but we'll get into that. Adam, we're excited to have you back. For all the losers that haven't listened to the last three episodes in a row, can you just reintroduce yourself to the Development Hell audience?
Hey, I'm Adam. I've written a couple of books on horror. My most recent one is about George Romero. Mm-hmm. I had a whole lot of fun writing it, and I'm really excited to share it with people. Yeah. Oh, and this has been a lot of fun talking with you about it, Josh.
Yeah, I've been really enjoying it. It's been fascinating. I just was talking about you guys offline. I call it Romero School, and that's what it is. Mary Beth, welcome back to the pod. It's been a little while. How are you?
I'm so good. I'm so excited to be here to talk about some of my all-time favorite things.
Mary Beth, who are you, though? Tell us a little bit about yourself for people that forget.
Who am I? Well, most notably, I talk shit on the internet, but also I am the editor-in-chief of Dread Central, the co-host of the Scarred for Life podcast, and director of a movie and author of two upcoming books.
Mm-hmm. And she's my boss. Boy, I'm nice to her.
Sorry.
You guys haven't met before today, But I hear from a little birdie that you guys have like something in common, that there's like some star crossing going on. How are you guys connected in this vast, crazy world?
Well, somehow Adam and I both worked at the same tiny Chicago-based archive called Media Burn. And I believe we missed each other by not very, like, by just a couple of months. I was an intern there while I lived in Chicago during grad school, and I left in 2019.
Yeah, and I'm a curator there now, and everybody speaks so highly of Mary Beth. They said that she was extremely competent and also very fun and has a lot of tattoos.
These are all true.
Yeah,
from everything that I've experienced so far. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're seeing it all.
Seems right. Yeah.
Cool.
Very Thanks. Interesting.
Yeah.
I love that. Before Adam's going to take us on a little bit of a seminar into Romero's woodland adventures, I want to talk about the two major themes at hand today because, well, I'm fascinated by both of them. So as a reminder, today we are talking about George A. Romero's sort of foray into Bigfoot found footage. I'm dumb, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure there's more than one project. I think they kind of evolve into one another, and this is where Adam's going to like really help us out down the line. But before we get there, I want to talk about, first, found footage. What is it? I'm confused. And also, Bigfoot. Same questions. So much going on there. So, yeah. Mary Beth, as a found footage defender, I'm going to start with you. What is found footage, and can you give us some mainstream examples?
Absolutely. So, In a nutshell, found footage is first person in world camera horror, which basically means you are aware of something recording in the world, and it is most often a person holding the camera defined by a shaky cam. And this can also take many other forms, including like screen life horror, which is like Unfriended or The Den. We see recordings of Zoom meetings and using the internet. But more kind of mainstream, straightforward found footage examples where it's we found this footage somewhere in the woods. It's proof of something bad happening. The Blair Witch Project is, of course, number one in everyone's hearts. There's also Cloverfield and Paranormal Activity are some big ones, As Above, So Below. These kind of follow that straightforward, this footage was found and documented a terrible event from one single perspective, and we are now watching that happen, and it looks very amateurish. And that is kind of found footage in a very small nutshell.
Interesting. Adam, why do you think it's such an effective subgenre? Why do you think people are often so affected and scared by found footage?
Well, it's at the foundation of horror as a literary genre too. It's kind of how we've been telling horror stories for a really long time. You know, if you think about like Dracula as an epistolary novel, you know, like that's essentially the written version of a found footage horror film, right? Mm-hmm. Or something like Orson Welles's radio broadcast of War of the Worlds that we talked about last week. One of the things that makes horror really scary is like extreme subjective experience. And so anything that can put us into the perspective of somebody who's being terrorized is a really useful device for telling a scary story in any medium. But I've written a lot about found footage horror movies, and like the thing that really gets me about them that you don't get as much in literary or audio stuff is just how scary the edges of the screen are, you know, because you're so dependent on the camera to try to figure out where the hell that dang witch is in the woods, or, you know, what's lurking in the shadows, or, you know, what's going to jump out at you. And that camera, it never seems to get there in time. There's always the possibility that whatever is there could just be off screen. And, you know, the good found footage horror movies know how to turn that into like a really sustained, terrifying sense of dread.
Absolutely. Yes. I think for me as a big scaredy cat, it just feels real. It really lends itself for suspension of disbelief and just to buy into whatever they're selling. I have always sort of heard the rumors about Megan is missing. I've always sort of like heard, you know, from Mary Beth, from the dark side of Reddit, you know, what's going on with that film. And I've never had the guts to watch it. And then one day I'm like, how bad could it be? It's probably like a crappy piece of shit, little indie horror movie. I'm going to watch the last 20 minutes of it. And I did. And now I am unwell and I don't feel good and I have to go to a hospital. So there's something about it. It's so easy for them to make it feel real. Mary Beth, I'm wondering, you were talking a little bit before about the different sub-genres within found footage. Can you walk us through those and like, you know, like what we've seen sort of in horror so far?
Yeah. So obviously, like I was saying, we have the more straightforward found footage that's usually framed by the device set up by Blair Witch Project that has a, you know, a title card at the beginning saying this footage was found thanks to the police department for giving us access to it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then we see an kind of an uninterrupted account of something terrible happening to a group of people, supernatural or otherwise. But then we have another format is the pseudo documentary, which is films like Lake Mungo or Behind the Mask, the story of Leslie Vernon, which I was on an episode about previously, that kind of take the format of the documentary, but make it horrific. And, you know, you see it with What We Do in the Shadows and more of like the mock the horror comedy realm. But Lake Mungo, again, kind of mimics the ghost, like kind of the ghost paranormal shows and becomes perhaps one of the scariest and saddest horror movies of all time, in my humble opinion. So there's that format. And then I also mentioned Screen Life, which is basically recording people's interactions via like digital interfaces. So cell phones, live streams, Zooms, and like I said,
screen. Is that just incorrect?
So here's the thing. These subgenres are so like fluid and weird that there isn't really like agreed upon terminology. So it's like I say screen life. People also say second screen. In screen makes sense. Not the problem, but these like newer subgenres, it's like there isn't a unified kind of language about them yet. But those are like the three big, like under the found footage umbrella, those are kind of like the three big ones.
The big bads, the big scaries. Yeah,
the ones that you can get.
Did you touch base on analog already? Were they just not listening?
No. So analog, it's interesting because analog horror is such like, it's such a fucking like a funny oxymoron of a title because it's like actually all digital horror, because analog horror has arisen a lot on YouTube and on TikTok specifically. And it's, again, emulating usually like 80s VHS aesthetics. Uh-huh. And it's usually told episodically. So there's like the Mandela catalog is the big one that everyone knows about, but there's a bunch of other series and they're all typically on YouTube. And it's interesting because again, they're all usually in digital places. They're not usually like feature length films, but they also are relying on techniques that make it look vintage, but also are very simple in their construction and that they almost resemble PowerPoint presentations. Like they're very easy and cheap to make. Like they're very low budget. They're very DIY, but if they're done right, they're really freaky. So, and it's like, it's very interesting because it's like found footage. There's so much of it now. So it's hard to always find the good stuff, but when it's good, it's really good. So that's like the emerging trend right now.
It seemed for a while, like, you know, it was just a couple of outliers, and then we had the Blair Witch Project, and then for like a decade, we really didn't see much in the mainstream, and then we got Paranormal Activity, and maybe there was a bit of a lull after that, but it seems like it's no longer a fad. Like, people like to categorize it as a bit of a fad, but in my opinion, it kind of seems like it's here to stay. And just in the last year, we've got so many interesting indie examples in the horror genre. I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about what we've seen recently in the found footage space that, like, we've found effective. Maybe we can give a couple of examples each. I'm going to start with you, Mary Beth, because I know that you probably have a couple on the tip of your tongue.
Yeah, so from, like, a more traditional found footage perspective, there's films like Frogman, which is cryptid found footage horror, which is, you know, very relevant to what we're seeing now, which is leaning into the creature feature aspect of found footage, which isn't done a lot. Because I think of, like, budget limitations, and a lot of times people think, oh, I can't do a creature feature on a small budget, but this film proves what you can do with limited resources and some really kind of smart thinking about how you can accomplish creature effects. Mm-hmm. And it's a fucking Frogman, so it's, of course, incredible.
Cool.
But I think another thing that I'm really loving is how narrative horror is adopting, like, hybrid found footage techniques, or using, like, found footage aesthetics, but maybe it's not a fully found footage movie. So I think of films like Skinamarink. That is not necessarily a found footage movie, but it kind of relies on similar techniques of the first person POV and the long takes and the use of darkness. And then films like Seder, which is a kind of a smaller release, but also it uses home videotapes from this guy's childhood to kind of shape his fictional narrative. And it's really cool to see how technology is being used in the horror genre to create really interesting films that play with perspective and creating truth and making us believe things. Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. Adam, I'm wondering, when you think of found footage, like, what are some examples that, you know, you've enjoyed or that have scared you or that, you know, you find effective?
So I've been thinking about this a lot. I wrote a thing for an upcoming Blair Witch project, like, big box set 4K release.
That, oh, did you maybe do that too?
In there?
The second, I think you sight? Did you do a second sight thing? Yeah. Yeah, me too. I wrote an essay for them too for that release.
I've been thinking about it a lot lately. And I went back and revisited stuff like The Wear Witch Project. It still bangs. Like, that's a hell of a movie. And it's just really, it's so audacious. Like, the decisions that they made at, like, every step of the way, like, how they structured it, how they filmed it, how, you know, they marketed it. But also, just, like, I very vividly remember watching The Blair Witch Project in Portland, Oregon, at the Cinema 21 Theater with a bunch of friends. We were teenagers, and, like, we drove in for the midnight screening. It was in the summer. It's like a Thursday night. That's when, that was, like, the very beginning. That was, like, it was, like, right after the new Star Wars, the Star Wars prequels, where, like, you know, if the film was officially being released on Friday, they'd have, like, Thursday night just after midnight screenings, and then would go all night long or whatever. And because Blair Witch Project was this horror film, they just had the one midnight screening. So it's like we were in the city after midnight on a Thursday. It was so exciting. And there was one friend in our group who was convinced that it was 100% real. Just an absolute documentary about some kids who died, which I feel like we pointed out, like, well, that's not scary and fun so much as, like, horrible. Sad, if that's what it is. Yeah.
Were you all trying to convince him that he was wrong? Like, what was the social situation there?
Yeah, to a certain extent, but also, like, we didn't know. Like, you know, everybody talks about the, like, guerrilla marketing, but And like, all the, like, the importance of the website and all that. But I don't think any of us had visited the website. Like, that was the days of dial-up internet. And, like, you just didn't go on the internet for a lot of things at that point. And so, like, some people found out about it. I think there was one person there who had seen the making of documentary that's like a...
I
think it's on the Blu-ray. It aired on IFC or something like that. And it's not, making of is not the right word. It's like a pretend documentary about the Blair Witch phenomenon, which I'm pretty sure they used as like a fundraising proof of concept sort of thing when they were still trying to fund it as like a regular sort of horror adventure movie. Mm-hmm. And then when that didn't work, they were like, well, what about this? So anyways, I've been thinking about the Blair Witch Project a whole lot lately, and that's a really good movie. It really holds up. It's so fascinating.
So fascinating.
There's parts of it,
it's still frightening to this day, no matter how many times you've seen it.
Yeah, it is scary, but also like the performances are so raw. Mm-hmm. And because they're like, you know, let's say semi-amateur actors who look like the most 90s people on Earth now, mm-hmm. It's, you know, it is easy to kind of make fun of. But like that kind of like raw emotion, you didn't see it in horror movies in the 90s. Like horror movies in the 90s were like cool and had quips and, you know, like that sort of thing. It was very much like people trying to rip off Scream.
Yeah.
And then here's something where people are just like sobbing out of terror and regret.
Yeah.
And
quite the opposite. There's nothing
exactly
shiny about it, like with the Scream franchise. For me, I remember I'm not as well versed with the subgenre as you guys are, as I have not been published in any books or DVDs, but I remember being in university and I don't know, it was like 2010, and my friend connected their big TV and it was the middle of the night and we watched Wreck, like the original.
Oh, Wreck. Hell yeah.
And I like had no idea what it was going to be. And I think it's one of the most like frightening movie experiences of my life. I think it was also around the same time that Left 4 Dead came out, like the zombie running game, and we like did it all on the same day, and I was like very shattered by both of those experiences. Wreck is fucking scary. I haven't seen it in a long time, and I don't have much memory of the sequels or the remake, but that first movie is just like mean and relentless, and it feels so fucking real.
Wreck 2 rules. It's so good. I highly recommend it.
Remember the wedding one more than I remember Wreck 2. I should revisit them.
Well, and it's interesting because, like, can I just be a little, like, found footage history real quick?
Please.
It's a really interesting little moment because 2007 to 2009 was, like, a big pocket for found footage because you had Paranormal Activity and Cloverfield come out in pretty rapid succession. And then you have Wreck and then Lake Mungo and the Poughkeepsie Tapes. And the Poughkeepsie Tapes is like a little
and what?
Well, there's one other major found footage movie. I'll give you a hint. Think about the theme of this miniseries.
Diary of the Dead,
yeah.
I don't know if that counts.
Of course it does.
No, it doesn't.
It premiered in Toronto before Cloverfield. Oh,
yeah, so did Survival of the Dead. That doesn't count either. No, we love Romero here. Sorry.
But it's like a really interesting pocket of like of found footage that I think is so incredibly important to the subgenre. And it also set off the initial found footage boom that got everyone tired of found footage. And again, like it was more Cloverfield and Paranormal Activity because those were the Hollywood releases and the others were indie or international. But at the same time, it was a really interesting kind of 1999 post 9/11 vibes and all of a sudden the found footage explosion. It's a fascinating timeline for the subgenre.
Really interesting thing to me is that Blair Witch Project was this like world shaking gigantic hit. And then there's only a handful of imitators.
Yeah.
You know, even Blair Witch 2 is not a found footage movie.
No, they were thrilled to not be a found footage anymore. They were like, we got a real budget. I remember learning from Mary Beth that there was something even before Blair Witch, that Thanksgiving alien abduction one.
So there's a couple. So there's the McPherson tape. There's the McPherson tape, which Dean Eliotto directed in 1989 that also became alien abduction, the incident in Lake County. So the McPherson tape was first, and then that's a whole other crazy situation where people found that and thought it was real, and like people at UFO expos were playing the movie like it was actual, and like people who were government officials were saying it was actual footage of aliens, and it was like, nah, dude, it's not real, and people think he's full of shit, and it's incredible. But like, that is considered the first found footage movie, and then there's like, you know, Ghostwatch, which is more like a faux broadcast, and there's the last broadcast that was in 1998. But like, it's not a super.
No,
it's really easy to plot like the single examples throughout.
And none of that really made the splash like the Blair. Well, nothing really made a splash like the Blair Witch Project.
Ghostwatch really, did it regionally, but that's it's different because it's just England.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and it didn't have like, I mean, Ghostwatch has been sort of rediscovered recently and people love it, but it didn't have like a huge, like a lot of people saw it and it was talked about, but it's not like there were a lot of people imitating it in the next few years. Like a lot of the stuff that's sort of grandfathered into the prehistory of found footage is really closer to like mockumentary. It not in the sense of being like funny, although some of it is. But just like there's always been fake documentaries, you know, like using documentary form as a way to tell a story. And like that's kind of what Cannibal Holocaust or Man Bites Dog or like a handful of other things in the 70s, 80s and 90s were doing, where it's kind of, you know, in like formally it's closer to Spinal Tap and Waiting for Guffman than it is to something like The Blair Witch Project or Paranormal Activity.
Mockumentary, right. Did you have another word for it other than mockumentary, Mary Beth?
Pseudo-documentary.
Pseudo-documentary, okay. Same, very similar sounding. I'm curious, I almost called you Lady Macbeth. I'm curious, Mary Beth, where are you headed this week?
I'm headed to the Unnamed Footage Festival in San Francisco, a festival dedicated to all things in-world camera and found footage.
Nice.
Very, very cool. I'm assuming that's like the biggest event of its kind sort of in that space.
Oh, yeah. Perhaps the only event of its kind. It's awesome.
Cool. Have you ever heard of it, Adam?
No, I haven't.
We're trying to like hype it up and like grow it, and I think it is year after year sort of getting bigger and bigger.
It is.
So
it's my favorite.
Have they premiered anything big? Like, did they world
Outwaters
premiere? Yes, that's where that landed. Yes,
last Outwaters, year. The second Horror in the High Desert.
Those are big.
They're doing the third one this year.
Do they have anything that like looks like it's going to be possibly a big hyped world premiere? Or is it hard to know?
It's hard to know because some of them are so weird, but they get their audience, or I'm obsessed with them and no one ever watches them. So it's hard for me sometimes gauge like some stuff that's playing there I've already seen or like has already been another, like Frogman's playing, which is cool, but like I've already
seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's a couple cool ones that I've seen that are going to be there. It's all really awesome stuff. That's like, it's the quality. Consistent quality in their films from I started going 3 years ago to now is wild. Like, it's really cool. So
cool. If it's okay with you guys, maybe we can start into our second subcategory, which is Bigfoot horror, cryptid horror, all of that kind of thing. This is something I really don't know too much about, and I think at least with you, Mary Beth, this is something you're really, really passionate about. Adam, what's your personal relationship with cryptids and Sasquatch and Bigfoot? Is it something that you like have a personal vested interest in?
Well, I'm from the Pacific Northwest, and the Sasquatch is kind of the semi-official mascot of Washington State, you know.
Okay.
But they're always kind of lovable creatures. I don't think anybody actually thinks there's anything, but there's Sasquatch, you know, imagery everywhere. And I don't know, I just like creatures, and I appreciated growing up in an area that was just like, well, we're going to take a creature as our mascot, you know, like our regional mascot is a creature. I'm a big fan of that.
It's very bizarre to me. It's giving Nessie right? Like, I never could pinpoint if people wanted to be scared of these things or if they wanted them to be friendly. And I still am not certain about that. So, Mary Beth, like, can you tell me what cryptid horror is? Is that where Bigfoot and Sasquatch sort of land?
Yeah, so cryptids are essentially these creatures that are mostly existing in folklore, but are also thought to be real. So they are like Bigfoot, Mothman, the Flatwoods Monster, Fresno Nightcrawler, like these friends back here, that are like legends, but also thought people think that they've seen them. There is a lot of people think that there's visual evidence that they exist. And so a lot of cryptid horror is often found footage because it is documented evidence of seeing one of these cryptids. There is not a lot of cryptid horror, and there is even fewer examples of good cryptid horror. When it's done right, it's awesome. But I have a huge soft spot in my heart for cryptid horror because I love cryptids in general, and I think that they are an incredible thing.
Marybeth, what the fuck is Bigfoot? What the fuck is Sasquatch? Like, what are these things?
So, for context, everyone, I used to work on a show called Finding Bigfoot when I worked at Animal Planet. I was the digital and social media producer for that show and learned a lot about Bigfoot. I even got to go Bigfooting. I live in Maryland. I got to go Bigfooting in Maryland, in Potomac. If you've watched Real Housewives of Potomac on Bravo, it is the same location where those women are from. I went Bigfooting with a 4'8" woman named Gudrun, who climbed like one of the highest peaks in Yosemite, which is like a huge deal. And she sent me, and I still have it in my email, recordings of Bigfoot singing.
Oh, he sings.
Yeah. So this is the thing about Bigfoot. So you think of Bigfoot, you think of a bipedal ape, giant, hairy, stinky.
Hot.
Yeah. Josh's type. Yeah. They're said to populate the wood, like, again, like Adam was saying, Pacific Northwest is where there usually are, and lots of like heavily wooded places. But in Finding Bigfoot, they claim that they're everywhere, including Maryland. But they're basically bipedal ape creatures that are very elusive, and no one's ever really gotten proof of them except for like some footprints and the Patterson-Gimlin footage, which is the famous like Bigfoot. That is like supposedly evidence of Bigfoot, but there isn't really like a lot of it.
Is this such a phenomenon? Like, why are people so obsessed with it? Why is it such a part of like people's culture, do you think?
So importantly to acknowledge, like a lot of like Bigfoot especially like also has roots in like indigenous like lore and folklore. So I think these are stories that have been around for a really long time because they are timeless. Like a giant monster's in the woods, don't go in the woods. It's like a kind of like a cautionary tale that we're all familiar with. And I think having that imagery of it being kind of scary but also kind of friendly, it becomes a figure that you want to hear more about, but there's still a little bit of fear into it, but it's also become so ubiquitous at the same time. And I think, and especially now online, when you can make memes of all this stuff, it gets even weirder because people like hyperfixate on these figures and all
people
this
are stuff. Obsessed but, yeah. with it. I was making my little like Instagram story for this episode, and I like went to like type in Bigfoot in the music section to see what's there. And there's literally thousands and thousands of bluegrass songs of people going like, Bigfoot's out there, he's gonna get you. Like, it's just like it's
go squatching, ubiquitous. Man. Go squatching.
Adam, do you think it's real? Do you think there's any truth to this Bigfoot Sasquatch phenomenon that we just don't understand?
No, but it is the most harmless kind of like delusionary paranoia kind of thinking. Like, it's fine. It's fine. It doesn't hurt anybody. If you love your monsters and you want to find a monster, like that's fine. That's absolutely fine.
What's the difference, and this is for both of you, between Bigfoot and Sasquatch? I'm sorry if that's a very stupid question. I've always wanted to know.
It's just different names. They're just the same. They're the different names for the same thing.
Sasquatch is preferred nomenclature in the Pacific Northwest, so
less offensive.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
It's okay. All right.
We don't say the B slur on this podcast, please.
I listened and I learn, and I think that's a really important thing. Bigfoot horror. I like, as an outsider here, I always kind of feel like Bigfoot is sort of not taken seriously in the horror realm. If we're experiencing it, it's kind of campy. It's very Roger Corman. It's nothing to take seriously. And I'm wondering, like, what are the classic examples of Bigfoot horror? Are there any, is there anything like noteworthy or worthwhile out there?
Well, if I could like pose something for Mary Beth, who's the Bigfoot expert here. I feel like the key to making a good Bigfoot movie is that the creature has to look cool.
Mm.
Even if you're like keeping it off screen for 99.9% of the movie, like the creature has to look cool. And that's where like the difficulty lies, because it is really hard and really expensive to make like a good Bigfoot suit. You know, like I've spoken to filmmakers who have tried to do it, and, you know, like a couple of them have been like convinced that the fake Bigfoot footage out there is real, because like, God, it's just so hard to make a it's so hard to make a suit. Like, there's no way that somebody would just do that for fun, you know, like it's so expensive. There's no way. Why would they do that? But, you know, so. Mm-hmm. What if, Mary Beth, you tackled this? What's the coolest looking Bigfoot?
Whoa.
In movie history, or, you know, in that. Moving images.
So.
I mean, it's Harry and the Hendersons, right?
I was going to say Harry and the Hendersons. I was like, it's Harry and the Hendersons is really it's the Harry best and the Hendersons, one.
Yeah.
Because that's the only one that you see him for a long time. And like,
I learned about that on 30 Rock, and it's. Nuts.
I loved that movie growing up before I know it's, but like, again, I was super, so like, I loved cryptids growing up. Like, I got books about aliens and monsters from the library all the time, and I made my family watch fucking Harry and the Hendersons because I wanted a Bigfoot in my life. So like, that was my movie. That's the best one, because everything else that I can think of with Bigfoot is either cheese balls or like you don't see it a lot. Like, maybe a distant second is Exists, the Eduardo Sanchez found footage Bigfoot one, because they do a good scary Bigfoot, but you don't see it a lot. But all the other ones that I can think of are like that you either don't, you just hear it, or it's cheesy. Because like Willow Creek is really good, but you don't see the Bigfoot really.
Like at all?
No, it's mostly you hear it. It's like the sounds, which is awesome. But again, like, and then there's Boggy Creek. The
Legend.
But that's like kind of cheesy.
Interesting. Yeah, there's something about him being like an ape man that just doesn't lend itself directly to it's being something that scares me.
So easy for it to just look like a shitty gorilla costume for Halloween. Yeah. Like, it's really easy for it to look.
You turn it into like a wolf man. And then all of a sudden it's so easy for him to be scary. And I don't know, like, what is the difference there? Is it because apes are more friendly and more, like, recognizable to us?
I think it's because there's less transformation. Because it always looks like a dude in a suit, right?
Yeah.
Like, Harry and the Hendersons does that, and the guy looks cuddly and friendly, and you want to give him a big hug.
Yeah.
You know, Chewbacca's kind of like that. And even if he's, like, a, you know, supposed to be, like, a badass warrior or whatever, like, the appeal of Chewbacca is that he's a cuddly teddy bear that you get to fly around in space with. Like, that's the appeal of Chewbacca.
That's the future liberals want.
It's true.
Yeah, right?
But I think, like, what also helps your Bigfoot be scary is if, like, you... Because I think Exist does this. I haven't watched in a while. But, like, it sets up, like, the destruction that the Bigfoot can do really well. So when you see the glimpses of it, you're already kind of freaked the fuck out by whatever it's doing.
Yeah.
So I think it's also like balancing, making sure you actually make it scary and not silly. Because I think, again, it's so easy to make, like, you know, they have all the exploitation movies that have Bigfoot, or like.
Then I might as well just say, like, what I don't like is movies. You don't see a ton of them, but they're pretty, like, you will find them in like the last 10, 15 years that are like aping bad horror movies. Like, you know, with slightly better production values or whatever. I just like, I don't know, like, oh, this is supposed to be cheesy, like a bad horror movie. Like, be a comedy, like, have the guts to be a comedy, mm-hmm. or, like, be a horror movie that might be cheesy.
I agree. Like, if you're making a movie and it's bad, and I'll be able to find something to enjoy in that. But if you're making the Velocipasta, like, that's not necessarily for me. Well, I really hope in a bit, when we sort of talk about Romero's found footage Bigfoot project, that you'll remind me, Adam, about the connection between the Blair Witch Project and that team and Romero, because it's such an interesting bridge. But yeah. Before we get there, you know, why don't we just, like, end off our Bigfoot horror section? Exists. Yeah, I have always wanted to see it. I kind of feel like that's the only scary example, maybe. Would that be fair to say?
It's pretty scary. Good movie.
I haven't seen it.
I really do like Eduardo Sanchez's filmography. For somebody who had, like, you know, the world's biggest, most profitable hit, he's been pretty much under the radar ever since The Blair Witch Project, but he's made some really phenomenal movies. I really like his stuff.
Mary Beth has produced films with him.
Oh, seriously?
Multiple.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, a couple.
You both were executive producer on The Jester?
And then Last Night at Terrace Lanes. And then there's two more coming up.
So you did four with him. That's so cool. Were any of them found footage?
Ghost Games Hybrid found footage.
Okay. Well, and on that note, I think we should talk about why everyone's actually listening to this episode, which is George A. Romero. We've been touching base week by week on the different projects that he didn't really get to finish. And usually they were big IPs. So we had Resident Evil or we had Goosebumps. Today we're going into a direction that's a little bit more original in concept. And I'm kind of excited about that. Adam's going to take the lead here. So he's going to be sort of our Romero professor, and me and Mary Beth are going to be taking notes and asking dumb questions along the way. Adam, I mean, do you want to kick us off? Do you want to tell us a little bit about, you know, what Romero was up to?
Yeah. So this goes all the way back to the early 1970s. And it's something that Romero worked on, not, you know, consistently, but that he would come back to. It actually ended up being something that he worked on through the mid 2000s. And I'll trace all of that in a second. But it starts like undated scraps of paper that I found in his archive, you know, short stories that he wrote, proposals that were very clearly ripping off the first section of 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Okay.
You know, with the apes, one of them almost ripped it off, you know, beat by beat with a couple of different like elaborations.
Wait, do you think that was conscious on his behalf or unconscious?
Somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
I would say he was a huge Kubrick fan. You know, you see there's several movies of his that, like, stealing from Kubrick seems harsh, mm-hmm. but that, like, let's say they take inspiration. Nowhere more like directly or explicitly than this project that he called Enemies, that he started working on, like, I would guess like 70, 71. So Night of the Living Dead had been kind of a hit, but they didn't really see much money for it. They were trying to get some more features off the ground, but also to create like a production studio, really, trying to turn Pittsburgh into a center for feature films. And they were looking at all sorts of collaborations and just sort of developing ideas and all of that. And so it starts off as this ripoff of 2001, the beginning of 2001, and then the next draft, he changes the story considerably, gets much more into like the inner workings of this like cryptid pre-proto-human ape-like society, and it's pretty clear that that's where his interest lies.
Uh-huh.
So a couple years later, Romero's metaphorically in the woods. Like, he's deep in debt. He's had three flops in a row, two of which basically didn't come out. The other one barely came out. That's there's always Vanilla, Season of the Witch, and The Crazies. The Crazies would be re-released in a couple of years and make some money, but at the time, like, you know, he was more or less washed up as far as, like, people funding movies were concerned. So he's trying to drum up interest for something else, something new, and he starts toying with this Bigfoot project that picks up a lot of these ideas from the Kubrick thing, but gives it this proto found footage structure. So this project is called The Footage, which I think we've mentioned on this thing before, that it's just the worst pun in the world. George Romero is the worst at coming up with titles.
Wait, like, for all the idiots out there, can you just like walk us through exactly what The Footage means?
Yeah. So because it's about a TV show that shoots in the woods, so it is literally about the footage that they shoot.
Right.
But also Bigfoot footage, that's just a terrible pun.
Oh, I love
it. And there might also be something in there because the hero is a football player, like footage in there too.
Oh,
like,
my God.
Yeah.
Literally perfect.
What a kid.
It's perfect. You know? Like,
we were not good enough for him.
So I've just never seen it. It's like, you know, some people have face blindness or just like can't see certain colors or something like that. Like whatever the part of your brain is that can come up with a good title. Like the man wrote just he never had anything resembling writer's block. He could always write, had a million good ideas, could come up with fun ones, cheesy ones, brilliant ones. He was a great writer. But when he had to come up with a title, it always was terrible.
Can I pause you and be a nasty bastard for a second? Mary Beth, do I have that disease too? Or do I not? Mary Beth, you know what I'm trying to make you do here? Tell everybody how good I am at titles. Tell them. Don't laugh. She's here. You know,
Josh is like headline.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, emperor is probably the best way to put it. I will say it's
I really like.
I'm not blowing smoke. Actually, it's actually quite impressive. It's kind of terrifying.
I remember being a little kid and being like, I wonder if I can get a job just like coming up for names for like other people's businesses and restaurants. It's not a job. Yeah,
you sort of do that now, ish.
I mean, I think that job is called consultant, and it's a bullshit job. Marketing. But somehow, people get paid like millions of dollars for it.
I know. I gotta switch industries because podcasting is not giving me that. Okay, so we have the footage. It's Bigfoot. It's football. It's it's camcorder in the woods.
So can I say something about the origin of the football thing?
Yeah.
So this comes from Dawn of the Dead. In 1972-73, Romero meets with AIP, American International Pictures, about producing Dawn of the Dead at that point, which was he had written a treatment that was really detailed, didn't have an ending yet, but it was set in a mall. There were, you know, semi-intelligent zombies wielding rifles and running a network of human meat distribution out of the butcher shop. And also there is a one-eyed telepath in a robe who may or may not have been human controlling the zombies. There's a lot going on.
Very Mall of America.
Yeah. But there's a letter in the archive of George responding to that meeting where, you know, it seems that AIP might have been willing to produce Dawn of the Dead to fund it. But in that very brief window, they were having success with blaxploitation horror, So he wanted to they wanted him to have an all black cast, which Romero was fine with. He was absolutely fine with it. But they also wanted him to cast a famous athlete in the lead role. And Romero was a bit concerned about that, both because, like, there's not that many famous athletes in the 1970s. He wasn't really a sports guy, and evidently wasn't, like, you know, AIP was producing stuff with Jim Brown, you know, like that sort of thing. Like, he was a famous athlete who was in a lot of blaxploitation movies.
Okay.
But Romero had just completed a documentary that aired on CBS, I think, all over the country on like the day after Christmas, that was profiling O.J. Simpson. It was called O.J. Simpson, The Juice is Loose. Juice on the Loose. Sorry, Juice on the Loose.
Is it Beetlejuice?
We're with you. So he, I believe, like, tried to get back in touch with O.J. to have him star in the first version of Dawn of the Dead, but it wasn't working. O.J. was pretty busy at that time being in, like, real Hollywood movies and, you know, preparing to be a famous murderer.
Committing murder? Jesus.
Well, he wouldn't actually commit it for a while.
Allegedly. No, I'm kidding.
Yes.
Oh, no. Everything's about to fall apart here in a second.
It was me. No.
So Romero's idea that he proposed in this letter was not to try to find, like, the one famous guy, but to cast a bunch of athletes in it. So it would, like, he would rewrite Dawn of the Dead so that it wasn't just, like, one hero, but there were a bunch of them, and he could cast, like, a bunch of the Steelers there, you know? So, anyways, that obviously never happened. My suspicion, like, Romero had health problems at the time. That may have played a role in it. But my suspicion has always been that, like, right around that time, there were a bunch of, like, blaxploitation horror films from AIP that completely flopped at the box office. Like, the second Blackula movie, it didn't flop, but it didn't do really well. There was a zombie movie called Sugar Hill that did terribly and got terrible reviews.
Yeah.
So I just have to guess, because this was like a transitional period for Romero when he wasn't working with the Latent Image folks that he came up with, and he was just starting to, you know, develop a new crew. So not a lot of people know. Like, I've talked to a bunch of people who are like, I didn't know he met with them about Dawn of the Dead. And, okay. So all we can do is guess. But anyways, after that, he came up with, like, a couple of different projects that could star a bunch of the Steelers. And one of them was this, that was possibly going to star Franco Harris, the, like, beloved running back for the Pittsburgh Steelers football team. Possibly Terry Bradshaw also, unknown. But yeah, so that's why he was... That's why the main character in this TV show within the world of the footage is a football player.
Bizarre.
What the heck? That's nuts.
Yeah, that's...
That's bananagrams.
Not what I was expecting to hear. No.
No. Yeah,
that was a bit of a digression, but I feel like, I don't know, like, I love sharing this stuff with people. It's so weird.
So weird,
but I kind of love it. That's really weird, but, like, cool as hell. But just, like, holy shit, what?
Yeah, and he's got, like, a solid history when it comes to diverse casting and, like, working with people white. So, I mean, it kind of, like, it makes sense, but I'm also could have been such a disaster.
It's so funny because, like, you read the letter that he wrote, and actually I should say, I don't even know if he sent it. Like, this is just his copy that's in his archive. So I assume if he wrote it, he would have sent it. But, But yeah, he's just like, all black cast, fine. Yeah, of course, that's fine. But an athlete, we really got to think about that.
I'm with them on that. They're not best. What was the movie O.J. Simpson was in? What was the big comedy?
He was in a bunch of movies. He was in the Naked Gun movies, which were my favorite when I was
a kid. Was he really?
Oh, yeah. He chucks a baby in it. I remember being like, oh, no.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyways, so... anyway, right, so the setup for this movie that he comes up with is a beautiful setup. I love everything about this. He never wrote a full script, but there is a couple of different treatments that have some variations. And I'm just completely in love with this project. The idea is that it's like a hunting outdoorsy show where they get a non-outdoorsy type, like this week, the football dude, to learn from, like, experienced professional, you know, hunter-ish, fisher-ish type people and hang out in the woods for a while. And then they broadcast that. Uh-huh. And while they're doing this, they come across a, like, community of Bigfoots.
Big feet?
Yeah.
No, it's Bigfoots.
Bigfoots? Okay.
I'm not kidding. One time I got a lecture why it's Bigfoots, not Big Feet, from a Bigfoot.
Do you remember the goose versus moose versus meese controversy from like 10 years ago? Anyway, that's all. Okay. We talk that very soon in Canada.
So you have this like film documentation of these, you know, previously thought to be mystical creatures who are just like living their lives in this like utopia in the woods. Also the greedy producer grabs the baby and runs.
Like a Bigfoot baby?
So yeah, the Bigfoot baby who's supposed to be real cute. Yeah. Grab it. So
I'm glad that there's a cute Bigfoot baby.
That would have been me. Yeah, if it was me and Mary Beth, I'd be like, we gotta grab it. Okay.
Well, in a little bit, I'll share some of the sketches, the creature designs with you.
Fuck yeah.
They're pretty great. It got like far enough along that there's a bunch of designs, but I think that, you know, like I said, Romero was really in the woods, again, metaphorically, at this point. Did not have much money. So as far as I can tell, he just like found some friends who taught for art schools and had them put up like advertisements in the hallways, like design a Bigfoot for $20 and we may use it in a movie. I talked to one of the artists who had absolutely no memory of this whatsoever. And he was like, you got the wrong guy, man. He wrote back one day later and was like, wait, that's my signature. What the hell?
Wow.
And so we like hashed it out and we're like trying to figure it out. And, you know, like that's the guess that we came up with.
Be careful with drugs, kids. Just be careful.
I think it's just it's 50 years ago and it was like a dashed off thing that he did for $20. Like,
and acid. Yeah, that's hilarious.
Sure.
I saw a couple of the sketches that you shared and there was like, there was male Bigfoot, and the one that I really liked was Fat Bigfoot.
Fat Bigfoot, yeah.
Fat Bigfoot.
Fat Bigfoot. Yep. I love diversity of size and Bigfoot. Beautiful.
Love Fat Bigfoot. Fat Bigfoot Body is my favorite person.
Yeah, me too.
He's my best friend. Yeah.
Think of the merchandising possibilities with Fat Bigfoot.
Yeah. No, I want Fat Bigfoot to happen.
Fat Bigfoot.
He's cool.
So cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep getting off on tangents. I'm sorry. I'm really bad at telling this story.
We love it.
But the bulk of the film is like arguments, debates, and fights about what to do with the footage and the little baby.
Oh.
But also, you know, like there are these giant creatures who can tear their heads off pretty easily that the hero gets to know. And he learns they accept him into their community, and he learns how wonderful their like utopian, you know, communal life is and all that.
Wow.
And at the very end, you know, all the greedy people, you know, get their heads ripped off. Because the villain here is not the monster.
I know
it is capitalism.
Yeah,
you knew where I was going.
Capitalism the whole time.
Yeah. And the hero destroys the footage.
Not the
one of the versions. Footage.
Sorry.
Yeah. One of the versions has him like watching as the Bigfoots take it out of the canister and throw it into the air like party streamers.
I love that.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I love this project so much, even though, like, again, it's not a full script. Mm. It's just like, you know, over the course of several different versions and drafts, like 50 or 60 pages. But I like this one means a lot to me. I love it. Feels like a real sort of skeleton key to who George Romero is.
Cool.
Beautiful. I'm sorry. When you said they get ripped apart at the end, like, did we get a sense that like this was going to be gory?
I feel like Romero had a really interesting relationship with horror at this point, where he wasn't really interested in scaring people. Like, I don't know. Like, if you think of George Romero's movies, like, other than Night of the Living Dead, which isn't necessarily scary 55 years later.
I think it is.
It was like trying to be scary, right? But like, he makes movies that are sometimes gross, sometimes funny, sometimes kind of confrontational, but they're not really like the kind of movies that make you scream.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like, that's not really something that he was interested in. And so he was trying to figure out, like, what makes something a horror movie at this point. Because it's very clear that he just sort of wanted to make this kind of, like, almost science fiction-y movie about, you know, like, a society of, like, proto-humans living peacefully away from society and away from capitalism.
Fuck capitalism.
Yeah.
I like
capitalism. Yeah. But because of capitalism, like, he had to make it into a horror movie. And there's like various points in his career when he's like, well, horror, I don't know, like, if I make it gory, then people think of it as a horror movie. So maybe I should make it gory. But I feel like that's not something he ever like felt deep down was important. So I really have no idea. I mean, everything is speculation. This isn't like the other projects that we discussed. Like, had full scripts, sometimes multiple drafts, and it was like, you know, he thought through everything. This was still at the speculative stage until he filmed it 2 decades later.
Would you say that it was a horror project sort of in conception, or no?
I mean, it's like a lot of Romero's stuff, and then it had one foot in the horror movie, but what makes him interesting, and I think what makes him important to the horror genre, is that he reinvented horror every time out, you know? Like, because he didn't want to just make a, you know, straight up monster movie or slasher movie or whatever. He wanted to find a way to express the stuff that was really, really important to him. And that often meant just kind of shaping the genre into something that could, you know, let him make a slapstick zombie satire on commercialism, you know?
What a cool
guy. You know, like Creepshow. Like, Creepshow is a weird-ass movie. Have you seen that lately? Like, now, all the, like, it's been ripped off so many times that, but, like, the idea of just doing something that stylish and weird and like filled with all of these, you know, like comic book imagery things.
Yeah. Is
like that. Nobody else was doing stuff like that.
No.
Not in the early 1980s. And, you know, even when he wasn't being like hugely influential in his innovations, like something like Martin's just like a really weird way to make a vampire movie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He was a weird guy. Cool. I'm not sure if we've touched base on this explicitly yet. Could you talk a little bit about the connection between the Blair Witch Project and Romero?
Yeah, so I just sort of threw out there that George filmed the footage two decades later. That was facetious a little bit. But when I was at Pitt, we found a VHS dub of a basically unknown short film that George Romero made with the Valencia Community College film program in the early 90s. It's a film called Jacaranda Joe that takes the premise of the footage, which, you know, again, was about a TV show for like teaching an athlete outdoorsy things, where they stumble across a Bigfoot, and it transports it to an extremely 90s setting that he could shoot for cheap in like a week with a bunch of film students. So it's set on like a sleazy talk show set. It is a talk show episode where they are discussing some like pre-internet, like semi-viral footage of a swamp Bigfoot that has become known as Jacaranda Joe, that was recorded by a TV show that was filming in the swamp that was about a athlete who was being taught outdoorsy things by professional outdoorsy things for a TV show. Mm-hmm. And so it's all after the fact. Romero was down there for like something 10 days. He shot it on 35mm film. It's really weird and funny. It ends really abruptly. He had always talked about wanting to finish it and wrote a proposal for a version of it that would have been funded by an actual studio that would have been closer to something like Ghostwatch, actually. Where it would start out as the talk show, and then this like sleazy talk show host would be like, and now I'm taking this helicopter to go live from the swamp where I'm going to find the Bigfoot. And then it would be about the Bigfoot, like killing every one of his crew one by one.
Got him, Bigfoot.
that never got made, but like it did end up like shaping more projects. But anyways, so one of Valencia Community College's alums who had graduated just a year before was a producer named Greg Hale. Greg Hale would go on to produce The Blair Witch Project and I think all of Ed Sanchez's subsequent films, or at least most of them.
Yeah.
A lot of them. Yeah. And I talked to Greg about this. He was the one who actually like put me in touch with everybody who helped me like recover the original 35mm footage that had just been like sitting in a garage in Florida for the last like two decades or something like that. Greg rules. He's really nice. It was really helpful. So here's the thing. At the time when Romero was making this, proto found footage movie, not quite found footage, but very close to it, Hale, a recent graduate, was on campus and around campus working with a lot of the same students, producing a short film by some outside directors who were being brought in. They were going to University of Central Florida, I want to say, for film school, and were working with Valencia students for a sort of visiting director's project. Their names were Eduardo Sanchez and Daniel Murek. making a short film at the same time that George Romero is making Jacaranda Joe. So the thing is that nobody watched Jacaranda Joe other than the editors who edited it until like we put on a screening at Pitt a couple years ago. Like literally nobody had seen it. There's no credits. Like George had probably seen it at some point, but it's not like it was screened publicly. And definitely nobody at Valencia had seen it. So it's not like the Blair Witch dudes saw this and were like, we're going to rip that off. But I really like to think like my version of this history is that this completely unknown George Romero movie that I'm extremely fond of was something that they were vaguely aware of. And when they were trying to produce the Blair Witch Project, but couldn't get the funding to do like the bigger production that they wanted to do, was rattling around in the back of their heads that this might be a solution, you know, subconsciously, because George Romero had done something very similar just a few years earlier that they were aware of, had never seen, but, you know, knew kind of what he was doing. That is my history of horror right there. I love it.
I love it, Adam. And, you know, if they weren't, Romero was definitely influenced, like, you know, all independent horror filmmakers on some level, but
oh, yeah.
Pretty nuts that there's such like well, a...
So he returned the favor. I'm sorry to just keep going on, but after Land of the Dead came out, and it's not like it was a flop, but it wasn't a huge hit. Like Romero just kind of like that was a really exhausting, very expensive and huge production. So he wanted to like go back to his roots. I think his son had gone to Valencia. He was pals with the head of the film program there. And so his plan was to take this pilot script that he had written for a Night of the Living Dead TV show that was going to be filmed found footage style.
Cool.
That he had written in like the early 2000s. And he like makes a couple of references in the beginning to like, I think he gets the name wrong, but he keeps referring to it as like Burkitt's Town or something like that, as like an homage to Blair Witch Project, you know, like an explicit homage, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Burkitt's Town.
So Romero is like at the point in his career when he's like, fuck it, I'm just going to do that. That's what I will do. I'm going to go make this Night of the Living Dead pilot with these film students. It's a script about film students who are making a movie when the zombie apocalypse breaks out around them. And then we see, you know, from their cameras, everything that happens. And it was meant to be an ongoing TV show, but it was a pilot script. You know, they could do it and make like a mid-length movie, whatever. He didn't care anymore about like, you know, money, whatever. But then like out of nowhere, some company shows up with money and we're like, hey, George, we're in a brand new independent film production company. Let's give you some money. And he said, okay. So he expanded the script a little bit, put in a couple of like action scenes, rewrote one of the characters to give it a female lead who's a bit tougher and more critical of the main characters, and called it Diary of the Dead. But he had written it with Valencia Community College in mind. I think it was no longer a community college at this point, but like that experience that he had had making Jacaranda Joe and that he would like very quickly like try to make with them. So that is in, you know, like 10 or 12 different steps, how a short story completely ripping off Stanley Kubrick ended up as the found footage horror movie Diary of the Dead 35 years later.
Yeah, I was going to say 4 decades later.
Yeah.
And that's why independent filmmaking is such a nightmare. And don't do it.
Yep. Don't do
don't
it.
Do it.
Don't.
That's cool. I mean, that's bizarro and beautiful. Mary Beth, would you have wanted to see Romero go down a Bigfoot route? Is this something that, like, you wish you could have seen from him?
I think so. I think so, yeah. I mean, like, it's hard to imagine it, but I also think that if someone was going to do it, he could do it. You know what I mean? I feel like he could accomplish something real fucking cool. I like the idea of it being like a reality show turned nightmare. So.
I do too. But like at this point, they had done the original. They had done two sequels. There was the killer remake, might I say. Like maybe it's time to try something new, boo. But you know what? It's easier said than done. So, moving to you, Adam. We have now done 4 distinct Romero projects that languished in development hell. Next week, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. But of these 4, if you had a magic wand and you could just make one exist, what would it be? And just for everyone's at home listening, what we've covered is Goosebumps, his R.L. Stine Goosebumps film, Resident Evil, the adaptation of the video game, his version of War of the Worlds, and now his found footage cryptid Bigfoot movie. So if you could make one of those a reality, Adam, which one and why?
Well, okay. So the best script of that bunch, I think, is the War of the Worlds script. It's really great. It's really sharp and interesting. It approaches, you know, the idea of alien invasion in a way that I don't think had ever been done before. It's like the commentary that it has is just like, it's really pointed. It really fits the 80s in a really interesting way. And he's thinking like historically, you know, tying back to like colonialist oppression in America's own past in a way that like nobody else was doing in, you know, like genre movies at that point. He was thinking really big. Mm-hmm. And I really love that movie so much, or that script so much. I would love to see him be able to realize that. Like throughout the 80s, he really wanted to make a science fiction movie, man. Like he just wrote a bunch of them. He wanted to, it's not that he wanted to break away from horror, but he wanted to break out of that box a little bit, especially like budgetarily speaking. And I just would love to see what he could have done, like if he had gotten to make that movie, what he could have done next.
Yeah, on that one.
I also feel like the work that he did on that script just is phenomenal. Like it's a great script. Like I hope that it, you know, like gets out there somehow someday.
And zany, but that, you know, it's like there's some bizarro lines in there.
Yeah. That may not have survived to a second draft, sure.
We don't know.
That's how he wrote.
Very nice.
But that said, if I could, like, just sorry, be even more long winded. Everything about the footage is just like really, it really touches all of my like pleasure spots. Like, I want to see. Even though it's so much sketchier in terms of like, it's very rough. Like he's still figuring stuff out. It would have changed a lot when he actually wrote a script or whatever. But like, I just love it so much. I like imagining what would have happened. Even if, you know, like the big problem of creating convincing Bigfoot creatures, especially on that budget, like may have been like an insurmountable problem, and not just one Bigfoot creature, but like a whole community of them.
Yeah, there's a baby.
There's a baby. There's a fat Bigfoot. Yeah, there's a grandpa Bigfoot.
Fat Bigfoot.
Fat Bigfoot.
God, I wish I could see what that would have turned into. Adam, I'm wondering if you could just tell us, you know, a little bit about your book. Where can we find it? And also, you, where can you be found on the internet if you wish to be found?
So the book is available all the usual places. It's called Raising the Dead, the work of George A. Romero. It deals with, you know, all of Romero's work that I could fit in. that includes the famous feature films, but also a whole bunch of these scripts. And I just sort of tried to figure out what all of these scripts tell us, not just about George as an artist, but about these movies that we've all seen 800 million times, you know, like, it's kind of interesting that you can find new things to say about Night of the Living Dead. But you can, if you look at the other stuff that he was working on right before it, and you see like a direct, like a one-to-one like connection between, you know, kind of pretentious medieval allegory type movie and Night of the Living Dead. So yeah, that's Raising the Dead. I'm online. My Twitter handle for now is m_Hulot. I've been on a little bit more recently than I have, than I do normally, just to try to get word out about the book. I've been doing some events. I did a screening of Night of the Living Dead at the Siskel in Chicago last week. That was so much fun with the great Dan Krause. This upcoming week, I'm doing a couple of things in Pittsburgh, and I'm traveling to Boston, Portland, and Seattle in the next couple of months. If anybody needs a Romero expert to ramble on endlessly about George for a screening, hit me up.
This is your guy. This is guaranteed. And Mary Beth, can you do me a favor and just plug some of these projects that you're working on in the world? Because there's a couple of them, and I want to hear about it.
Yeah. So first and foremost, you can follow me on social media. I'm at MB McAndrews on Twitter, where you can see me posting all sorts of weird things. I'm also at MB.McAndrews on Instagram. I'm my podcast, Scarred for Life, that I co-host with Terry Menard of Gaily Dreadful fame. I is at Scarred Podcast. I put out new episodes every week. And following me on social media is the best place to learn about all the things I'm working on outside of Dread Central in terms of books, essays, all that good stuff. I've got some cool news coming up regarding lots of found footage stuff. So follow along. And if you go to Unnamed Footage Festival in San Francisco, this is coming out after that, so never mind. Hopefully I saw you if you were there.
Uh-oh. And your podcast, Scarred for Life, has been nominated for a Rondo Award, which is the Oscars of horror. Are we still able to vote for that, or is it too late?
Vote until April 16th. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, vote for
and
it.
Where does one do that?
Yeah, Mary Beth.
So you can go to rondoawardsblog.com. It has all the information. I know, it's very old school. You have to email someone.
There's an
AOL email to email your ballot too, but it's easy.
That's how you know it's legitimate.
Oh yeah. So Dread Central's nominated for 4 awards. So if you want to vote for us for all on all 4 categories, that would be.
Yeah. Did you hear delightful. That bloody disgusting? 4. Sorry. No.
Oh Jesus.
I'm okay. Cut. Sorry. We love you.
Cut.
Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review. It really makes all the difference in the world. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.